The last matter on our calendar this morning is the case of Tonka on the Creek versus Gazalabova. Council, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask that you introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments and announce who you're representing in the case. And I'll give you a few minutes to get settled. And the appellant may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christopher Kala. I am the attorney representing the appellant, Tonka on the Creek, LLC. This is an appeal of an eviction action case from Hennepin County District Housing Court. The appellant is the landlord. The respondent is the tenant. The landlord gave notice that the lease would not be renewed. The tenant failed to vacate. There was a bench trial, finding in favor of the tenant. Landlord appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. There was no intermediate judge review per Rule 611 of the Housing Court. The tenant is still in possession. Landlord asks this court to reverse that portion of the trial court's decision that found a waiver and affirm that portion that found that there was good cause to give notice and issue an order awarding possession to the landlord.
And there's some dispute, I know, in the briefing about whether the district court found good cause but for the waiver. Is the finding of good cause, is that finding 44 in the order? Where did the district court find good cause but for the waiver?
Paragraphs 21 and 44.
So 21 and what?
Paragraph 21 starts the legal set. That's the legal standard. Under the terms of the lease, any material violation or repeated minor violations can be grounds for termination. And then paragraph 44, the referee says, the landlord has proven by a preponderance of the evidence that tenant has committed repeated minor lease violations by late payment of rent.
But then the court in 45 says, despite this, the Court of Appeals stated in Cimarron Village a trial court's reliance only on late rent payments in its good cause determination would be misplaced.
So I believe we're getting into more of a legal issue and talking about the affirmative defense of waiver. And I take the...
Let's go back to Cimarron, because you say it's distinguishable. You would agree that Cimarron says that good cause... If the only fact is that there are late payments under Section 42 housing, that is not good cause. Did I properly state what Cimarron says, holds?
The problem with the Cimarron case is it's proceeding off of a notice to vacate rescinded.
You say that this case is different because it's based on a holdover, whereas Cimarron was based on a breach of the lease. I think that's what you say in your papers.
Right. So Cimarron starts off with a notice to vacate.
I know.
Which is rescinded.
So my question for you is, you make that distinction, you say it's distinguishable because of that, but can you cite to any legal authority that makes that distinction?
Sure. In Cimarron Village, as I indicate starting at page one of the reply brief, Cimarron starts off as a notice case, and then that notice is rescinded, and then new notice is given. And in that interim, there were no late payments. And the theory in Cimarron was that the second notice was alleging that those late payments of rent that occurred prior to the date of the earlier rescinded notice cannot be a basis for a breach of lease or an eviction. That's what Cimarron states. And it's unfortunate that the setting of Cimarron doesn't carry through to the nuanced distinctions that other cases present. This case is just about holdover after notice. There was no rescinded notice. Now, had Tonka, in this case, given notice in June 2018 that we're not going to renew your lease because of late payments. I mean, back then, in June of 2018, that was the expiration of the normal term of the lease. They went month to month after that. And they said, we're going to evict you for breach of lease because you had all these late payments. And then they continued to accept payments. And I think that's the Oak Glen case. There were 6 months of payments in the middle that weren't late. That's not what we have here. We have a month-to-month tenancy that's terminable on 2 months' notice. And that's what happened. There was no rescission. There was no change of mind by the landlord. To take the tenant's position and apply Cimarron and Oak Glen to this case would state that the landlord doesn't have any choice except to evict for breach of lease. Characterize the late payments of rent as a breach of lease. The next time a payment is made late, refuse that and then bring an eviction, affording the tenant no opportunity to redeem. Instead, the landlord in this situation took the opportunity to simply give the tenant a notice of non-renewal. And I explain in my reply brief why a notice of non-renewal and a holdover eviction is a much better situation for the tenant than the brusque breach of lease setting that the tenant seems to think the landlord should have proceeded upon.
So your argument then is there needs to be, to avoid a waiver defense to this, the landlord need never decline any late payment. Is that right? So the even though the payments here, I think, were late even up until December. Is that right? Were the payments late until December?
The notice was given on December 27th.
Yes. Was it December? And I think at that, factually, I was just wondering what happened with respect to the payment. So at the time notice was given, was the tenant current in rent payments at that time?
No.
No. There was like $5 or something owing. And then I think payments were, I don't know if they were timely made in January and February. Maybe they were. But at some point then I think there was a credit actually.
So there was a $55 credit dated as of December 27th. And the transcript talks about why that is. There was some month-to-month
issues. Right, I think it reduced it from 60, and there was a credit applied to 55, and then
Correct.
We're left with an outstanding balance of 5. And then in January, somehow it gets to be a credit of 80, I think, according to the court's findings. I was just wondering, is that because December got fully paid up plus then January and February?
No, January she overpays in January.
Okay, to account for what was owing earlier?
And more. But still, that payment isn't credited until January 4th. And then in February, the payments are made again on February 4th, not the first of the month, which is what the lease requires to be timely. Not that there's a late fee that necessarily gets incurred as of the dates they pay that rent late in January and February, but it's still late. And ultimately, it's really irrelevant because the landlord has already given notice that you were going to be non-renewed.
And so, okay, so you're saying that Cimarron would only apply when the landlord is bringing an affirmative breach of lease or eviction for non-payment and doesn't apply in a holdover situation. Is that right?
Correct. Because in Cimarron, they rescinded the notice and then gave a new notice and alleged breaches of lease that predated the rescinded notice. And that's why the Cimarron court says you can't rely upon previous breaches if you've already rescinded the notice. I mean, that doesn't come out as strong as it could have in the Cimarron case because that really wasn't the issue. But
well,
as we look at...
I think, too, because Cimarron cites to Oak Glen, where Oak Glen, like, then... So speak to Oak Glen and why the, you know, which the court sort of says, like, the way to avoid the waiver argument is not to accept, you know, you need to refuse... A landlord need only refuse to accept the single final late rental payment. And I guess, why wouldn't that tell you that the landlord needed at least to reject a late December payment? I'm going to leave off for a second January and February, which seemed to me a slightly different animal because notice has already been given then.
So Oak Glen was a Section 8 project-based case, and it proceeded on breach only. There was no holdover case. In a project-based Section 8, there technically isn't holdover. You give the tenant notice of all of the lease violations, and if they're established, that is then material breach of the lease or material noncompliance, that's how the eviction proceeds. Oak Glen was not a notice case. Oak Glen was not a holdover case. It was a breach case. And in Oak Glen, there were 6 months of timely payments made prior to the time that the landlord filed the eviction for breach. And in Oak Glen, there were 9 breaches alleged. The trial court found just the one. And the trial court said in Oak Glen, breach of lease by repeated late payment of rent and plaintiff's acceptance of late rent payments did not constitute a waiver of the contractual right to terminate for repeated late payment of rent. Again, Oak Glen was purely in the breach context. There were 9 breaches alleged in that complaint. Now, why the landlord didn't do a cross appeal or a related appeal of the other 8 reasons that the trial court was silent on, I don't know. But we proceed to the Court of Appeals in Oak Glen only on the issue of late rent as a breach. And at the point of the trial, there had been 6 months of rent that was timely paid. I mean, had the trial court had a situation where in Oak Glen, the landlord commenced their breach of lease before those 6 timely payments, we might have a different situation. But the problem with Oak Glen is that the landlord took the position that they could have accumulation of breaches to establish material noncompliance, that they needed to kind of wait until they had a gravamen, until they had enough breach, a critical mass of breach, before they could proceed with the eviction. And the problem in Oak Glen is, by the time the landlord thought they got to that point, 6 months had passed, thereby diminishing the impact of the late rent payments as a breach. But why the other 8 weren't considered by the trial court, we don't know.
Well, could I mean, because I'm just trying to get a handle on how this should work. And if I look at the facts of the case, I mean, at least the way the judge analyzed it, there was chronic late payments throughout the termination of this lease, and there was at least an implicit waiver by virtue of the fact that the landlord accepted these late payments consistently for the entire period. A few months before the expiration, basically said, I'm not going to do this anymore, but continued to do it. And then once there was notice sent that there would be a non-renewal, there was no reason given. And I guess I'm trying to understand under Cimarron, why would it be different for a non-renewal as opposed to just an eviction during the term of the lease?
So I talk about that in my reply brief about why, you know, the different evidentiary standards and legal standards between a holdover eviction and a breach of lease eviction. I mean, the impact on the tenant for a breach of lease is much more severe. First of all, in the complaint, the breach is described with specificity, whereas in a holdover, it's not. And so there's prejudice perhaps to the tenant to have this unfavorable document publicly stating the breach of lease as opposed to simply a more ubiquitous holdover. Second,
is there any authority? I mean, I understand that it would be a more favorable situation, but is that in and of itself significant to basically ignore the course of conduct by both of the parties that are subject to this lease?
I cite the court to Central Union Trust Company of New York versus Blank, 210 Northwest 34, Minnesota Supreme Court, 1926. And it is the general holding in the doctrine of this court that merely by allowing the defendant to be in default, extending indulgence into him, the lessor does not lose his right to regain possession. The landlord, and this is a Section 42 property, the tenant pays half market rent. This is not a market rate property where the landlord should be expecting its tenants to be a lot more sophisticated and a lot more able to comply with all of the lease requirements. So the landlord does extend some indulgences to the tenant, and the one that they do here is they simply non-renew the lease. They don't do a breach of lease. I mean, a breach of lease, if this gets breached, she's got the balance of the lease term that she has to pay rent on, perhaps, whereas a holdover, the lease has been terminated. Her rent liability is extinguished.
Section 42, you can only, as I understand it, non-renew for good cause. Is that right or wrong?
The notice requires you to indicate that the tenant's lease is being non-renewed. If challenged by the tenant in court, then the landlord has to establish that the non-renewal is supported by good cause. They can't simply, I mean, the standard is you can non-renew anybody for any reason, no reason, just not an illegal reason. That does not apply to Section 42. You have to have a good reason. You don't have to put that in your notice.
Mm-hmm. But can't good cause, then we get to the question of, you know, apart from the general rules about, you know, well, in the case that you cited from 1926 or whatever, I mean, we're talking about the statutory requirement that there be good cause before you non-renew. And I mean, in this case, you might argue, well, the warnings were there already. Would you argue that there need be that a landlord could continue to take late rent, you know, without any mention or concern about it, and then decide to non-renew, and that still is satisfactory good cause if they later show a poor rental payment history? I mean, can good cause in the employment setting, for example, good cause requires some notice, and, you know, I mean, that's part of it, the idea. Do you think good cause is just late payments, even if the tenant had no idea that that put their month-to-month lease at risk?
Notwithstanding the tenant stating that she might not have known that, I believe it's unreasonable as a matter of law for a tenant to believe that late payment or non-payment doesn't put their lease in jeopardy. Remember, she is a landlord herself. She testified that she would not accept this type of behavior from her tenant. So I believe in this situation, the clear facts of her own testimony belie any belief that she didn't know that late rent payments was a problem with her tenancy with this landlord.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Iris. I'm representing the respondent, Vladika Zalabova. In this case, this landlord operates a Section 42 low-income housing tax credit building. So in return for renting 20% of their units in the complex below fair market value, they receive a tax credit for this.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're well aware of the facts, and I just want to make sure we utilize your time as efficiently as possible. Why, is there any issue at all here that there was good cause here because of the chronic late payment? I mean, isn't this really just a question of the waiver, whether it applies here or not?
I think both issues are relevant in this case.
Are you disputing that there was good cause?
I am disputing whether there was good cause because I think late rent payments can be good cause and sometimes they can't be.
Did you cross appeal and claim that that was a clearly erroneous finding?
No, we did not cross appeal. I think the judge's order on paragraph 44 or 52, there's no credible evidence that the landlord ever refused a late rent payment. There's no credible evidence of any other good cause basis in this case. So what that's saying, I think, is that for good cause, what is good cause? Late rent payments that are refused. If you're accepting those late rent payments, you do not have good cause.
But isn't that just really the judge saying there is good cause for chronic late payments, but the acceptance of the landlord may be a waiver of that good cause.
It kind of goes to both issues. So certainly it goes to the waiver issue, but I do think it goes to the good cause issue insofar as the Cimarron court explicitly held that accepted late rent payments, the lower court erroneously relied on those accepted late rent payments in their totality of circumstances good cause analysis. So to the extent this lower court relied on accepted late rent payments. Those could not amount to good cause to terminate this lease.
So in the facts of this case, I mean, I think it was clear that the landlord had concerns about late payments that started, you know, in there's the communications and whenever they are, September, October, November, in that time frame. Oak Glen, which Cimarron cites, and I, leaving aside that contextual difference right now between those cases, says that the last rent payment must be declined at, in the circumstances of that case. What is, and the rationale underlying these cases is that a person is the, a tenant has a certain amount of repose if you continue to accept, in those cases, I think, timely payments after there was a late payment. And then to spring it on them is, the tenant is, you know, unfair, and so they, the notion of waiver comes in. Here, what repose would there be? Where was the repose, and what precisely what rent payment did the landlord need to decline in order to maintain the non-renewal for good cause?
And the repose here is almost the entire term of the lease. They have 2 years of this implicit agreement where it late rent payments are okay. And I only disagree with your assertion that there was communication about late payments. There was never, all the communications were regarding just paying your rent.
They say, paying the rent that you need to pay.
Yeah, you need to pay. They're not saying, hey, we're not accepting late rent payments. These late rent payments are a problem. They're saying, you need to get us your rent. And if you don't get it on time, we're going to charge you a late fee.
So even if the landlord, under your theory, had declined to accept the December payment, and even January, well, I think the notice period is a little different because I don't know what repose the tenant could have when they've gotten a notice.
I'd agree.
Yeah. So if we're looking, I wouldn't think that the, well, let me ask you this. Do the January and February payments have any relevance to the alleged waiver argument related to the good cause?
No.
Okay, so we go back in time to the December good cause. You look at it at that point in time, presumably. And at that point in time, was there any way, did the landlord wanted to pursue that? Did the landlord need, how could waiver be avoided, if at all, either at that time or going forward?
Correct. And I think all you'd have to do in December when you get that late rent payment, return to the tenant, say, look, I'm not accepting this late rent payment, and maybe send a letter too and say, we've accepted, we have this course of conduct for 24 months, but that's now unacceptable behavior. We're going to enforce this term of the lease that we haven't been enforcing. And if you look at the case cited in appellant's brief, Boole v. Lensing, it's another Section 42 case where they get a tenant out for late payments. That's exactly what they do. They refuse a late rent payment, and they give notice to the tenant that we're no longer accepting the rent payments. And that counters
that repose. What was
that case again? It was Boole Investments versus Lensing. It's an unpublished case after Cimarron Village.
Okay. So I'm just trying to grasp what the issue is here. If I hear you correctly, it's basically the landlord has to make an affirmative revocation of the prior waiver.
Correct.
I mean that's what you're describing.
Yeah, they would have for waiver not to apply here. They would have to manifest some intent that late rent payments were a material breach of the lease in this case, and you simply don't have it. And it's not just a Cimarron case, I'd say that. It's not just the Boole partner. Oakland says that. Priordale Mall says that landlord could have easily have refused to accept rent and requested that rent be paid into the court while the case was pending.
What case would be pending in this case? Say, for example, it's December on this month-to-month, and then the landlord does what you described, doesn't accept the late payment. There's no case pending at that point in time. Are you saying that the landlord and gives notice? Let's say, I'm not accepting payment and I'm giving you notice in 2 months where I'm not renewing the lease. There's no case pending at that time until the holdover eviction in March.
So typically
the landlord have to bring that case.
I'd say they could bring that case in December when they...
Must they bring it to avoid waiver?
I mean, it's hard not to if you want to avoid waiver. And that gets back to this whole...
Well, I'm asking legally, is that what you're arguing the rule should be? If we're that the landlord needs to bring an eviction, not accept it, and bring an eviction action in order to avoid waiver.
Correct. Unless they have manifested some intent otherwise, either in writing or something. But in this case, you know, to style it as a holdover case isn't proper. You can never have a holdover tenancy in a Section 42 case. You have to have good cause, which is essentially a breach of lease. So at the initial hearing, when they file a holdover case, I move the court to dismiss this eviction because I'm saying, hey, she's Section 42 low-income tenant. You can't hold over that tenancy. They have a right to renew their lease unless there is good cause. And then they amended their complaint to say, oh, we have good cause.
So under your scenario, so long as the tenant is making timely payments, the tenant can stay, right? As a starting, I think the facts are in January and in February there were timely payments. And as long as the tenant makes those timely payments, the landlord can't do anything. Is that correct?
Correct. As long as they don't have good cause to otherwise get them out, they have to continue to renew that lease, and they're getting tax credits in response.
All right. If the tenant is late even once, and the landlord can basically say, well, this is a continuation of the same problem, or...
And I think you'd have to have it more. I don't think once would be sufficient for good cause. I think it has to be repeated violations. So it has to be multiple times. I don't think one late rent payment would be good cause to get.
So you think you start over on a new clock? Is that it? Without a lease, month to month? I mean, I'm just trying to practically understand the results of your argument. What would the resulting situation be?
Are you saying after we have a series of payments that were late?
Right.
So saying
April, May, June. April, there's a late payment.
So in this case, I think there's certainly now notice to the tenant that late payments are a problem. So possibly if you have additional late payments and combine it with a prior 24. But here they based it on a prior 24 where there was no notice, so that would be a problem. But yes, possibly now they would have good cause. And there's some dispute about January, February, whether that was paid late or not.
Even for one late payment?
For one late payment in addition to the prior, yes.
Holdover.
But if it was a new tenancy, a new lease with new parties, one late payment would simply not be enough. It has to be a series of violations, but here maybe.
And so taking that farther, it was month to month at the time this happened. In December, you're saying there wasn't good cause at that time and that they needed to, because they accepted the late payments. Maybe even apart from that, I'm not sure. Okay, then we have the notice period. Let's say then there's not good cause. Now we're in April, May, et cetera. If there's a late payment in April, and you're saying I think the tenant is on notice of the problem, does the landlord have to decline to accept that late payment to go forward? I'm trying to figure out what the declining of the payment, is that just a factor in letting someone know and there might be other ways of letting that person know, or is it somehow legally so significant that it always invokes the waiver argument?
I think it invokes a waiver argument, but I don't think anything's dispositive. I think waiver is a factual analysis. You have to take all of the facts in total and consider what was the manifest intent of the parties here. So again, it would be a factual question for the court to decide whether that one payment in addition to the others is sufficient for waiver or not.
Okay. Excuse me.
I was going to ask, do you think the district court, I mean, she titles something at the top of page 5 of 6, waiver. I'm trying to figure out what her exact analysis is and if she really did analyze waiver.
And I think the point or the she did analyze waiver in that section, and she's saying that it would essentially be by accepting these late rent payments, what you're doing is you're reaffirming the tenancy each time by accepting rent and providing a house. You're saying, I want to continue this lease. I want to continue this landlord-tenant relationship. And that's sort of the factual significance. While it's not the be-all, end-all, I think the court is saying that that was what these parties did. And in this case, when they're re-signing leases, despite late rent payments, when they're sending letters saying, pay us your rent despite it being late, they're not bringing it to the attention. I think that's what the court analyzed as being waiver and applied it here.
So if we look at, on paragraph 49, in that discussion, the district court, the last sentence says, in order to rely on the late payments as good cause for non-renewal, the non-renewal, landlord would have to have had to, would have had to refuse a subsequent late payment, see Cimarron. So if I can characterize your argument, you wouldn't, refusing a late payment isn't necessary in a case where there's been adequate notice, for example, given to the tenant. It's not legally required in everyone in order to avoid waiver. Waiver might be proved, or non-waiver, I guess, might be proved by other facts. Is that right?
I think the landlord could, I think it hurts the landlord, but they could manifest their intent in some other way.
Okay.
In this case, they filed an eviction or just sending a letter saying we're refusing to accept late rent payments like they did in the Bull case.
Well, and this comes back, the real issue here is the waiver or the revocation of that waiver, right?
Correct. And unless there's further questions, I don't have anything else.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to start with Boole v. Lensing. I was the attorney who appealed that case. I was the attorney who was involved in three or four of the underlying evictions. There was never a refusal to accept a late rent payment in any of the Boole-Lensing evictions. That statement by the Court of Appeals and that unpublished decision is just wrong, as a matter of fact. And those documents for all the Boole versus Lensing cases were provided to the trial court in a brief. Every eviction, every communication with the landlord, ledgers, there was never a refused payment until the last eviction against Ms. Lensing, which was for holdover. She tried to tender payment after the holdover date. That rent was refused, but prior rent during the term of the lease up until the holdover date was never refused. As to the argument that Section 42, you always have to show good cause, and it's never a holdover case, I direct the court's attention to page 6 of my main brief when I refer to the guide for completing Form 8823. The owner and tenant may renew the contract or enter into a new contract, thereby allowing the tenant to continue occupying the low-income unit, but the owner is not obligated to renew a lease or enter into a new one. And failure to do so does not per se constitute an eviction without good cause. The process for terminating a Section 42 lease is bring an eviction for non-payment, bring an eviction for breach, or give notice for holdover. And once holdover has occurred, at that point, the burden can shift back to the landlord if the tenant raises the issue, and the landlord simply has to demonstrate that the holdover notice was for good cause.
Right, and so, or it could, and if it was, if the issue that is the basis for the good cause was an issue that was in all the circumstances waived by the landlord, then there could be, I mean, here your focus is entirely on, you know, that you shouldn't have to decline a rent payment. But if you look at all the facts here, and there was not communications about the effect of these late payments, why, given all those facts, why isn't that a reasonable factual conclusion to draw that the landlord effectively waived the issue?
Well, there's a non-waiver clause in the lease that says waiver will not be done except by express agreement. And I think the repeated communications from the landlord that your rent is late, it's unpaid. I mean, I don't think the landlord has to give a very specific warning to a tenant, oh, by the way, if you continue to pay your rent late, we're going to non-renew your lease. There is no requirement at law in the Section 42 regs, in the case law in Minnesota, that says that. There's a generalized line of cases called the Cobb cases that says, yes, that can be. But in the Cobb case, that was a forfeiture. Okay, there wasn't, I mean, they would just went and seized that guy's truck after he made one more late payment that they never notified the guy about. We're giving this person here a notice of non-renewal, 2 months advance notice.
Right, but, I mean, we do have a difference in that there's a statutory requirement of good cause. There's more protection, obviously, for these tenants than there would be for anyone else that's non-renewed, right?
If this person had timely payments during the whole time, I would agree with you. Good cause was not shown. But Referee Hotelling, in her decision, let me grab that, paragraph 53, she says, there is no credible evidence of any other good cause. I think she's acknowledging that the chronic late payments is good cause, but for the affirmative defense of waiver, tenant is entitled to possession.
Well, and this gets back to my waiver focus here, because, I mean, it seems to me there's absolutely no issue here that there was good cause. The issue is whether there was waiver or not by your client. And I guess what I'm failing to understand, I think under the Cimarron case, that this course of action and the way the tenant and landlord acted during the course of this was that she could continue making late payments, and she did.
In Cimarron?
That there was a waiver. I mean...
Well, in Cimarron, there was a notice, and it was rescinded. And after that notice, there was no more late payments. And then the new notice came out, and that's what the court said.
Right.
This second notice is insufficient to allege, you know, as for good cause, based off of prior issues, because you noticed those earlier and you rescinded that. So you can't, that's why Cimarron says there was no late payments that were refused prior to the second notice after the first notice was rescinded. In this case, there was never an earlier notice.
And I think it gets into a fairness issue because the tenant is that. It's acceptable, and the tenant's done this forever, and it's an understanding by conduct that's how it'll operate. But once the landlord sent the notice and said, I'm not going to renew, then she made timely payments. So it's like, you know, there was a I guess you could treat it as a revocation of the waiver. When that notice and that indication that you were not going to, that the landlord was not going to renew.
Well, then this is the issue I raised in my initial brief. What is a landlord supposed to do for the rents for January and February? Simply not take them and then wait until March to do a holdover? They've lost 2 months of rent, and then the tenant says, okay, I'm just going to leave. I'm going to keep my rent. You're not going to get it for January and February. That puts the landlord in an unfair situation. That was the unfairness I was talking about in my closing argument. I mean, what the tenant is really saying is, you should evict me for breach sooner as opposed to giving me a notice to vacate later. And that type of an indulgence shouldn't be held against the landlord. I mean, I could have similarly argued a breach count as well as holdover.
Could I ask you one last question? And you just have and you're over time already, but do you agree that that you cannot deny a Section 42 tenant non-renewal for good cause, unless you have good cause?
Correct. Yes, I believe that a Section 42 tenant is entitled to explanation and proof of good cause if the landlord non-renews.
All right, thank you.
And we've never run away from that idea.
Okay, all right, very good, thank you. And we will take the matter under advisement and get a decision out within the statutory period of time.